We make our entrance into hour number two here on WEEI just after 11 o'clock, January 1st, 2025. Happy New Year out there, everyone. Dan Ball with you in for Jones and Keefe up until 1 o'clock this afternoon. All three of the college football playoff first round games will be aired right here on WEEI with coverage of those games beginning at 1 p.m. That's my good friend Tom Crisafulli on the ones and twos, getting us into hour number two. You went a little older school on that one, and I certainly do appreciate that.
So I realized this the last time we worked together.
Yeah.
You asked me to play a Jay-Z song as the outro. I was like,
I did.
All right, Dan. He's 26. He's close to my age. That's the type of music he wants to hear. So, you know, playing old school, that 90s rap.
That's right.
Thank God I did a 90s rap show my sophomore year of college, so I have a little knowledge going in. But yeah, love it.
Yeah.
Having a good time all the time.
There you go. Absolutely. We appreciate you spending your New Year's Day here with us. Text from the 401 made me laugh during the break. We want a disaster with an exclamation point. Lose any way possible. This was the part that got me. Shoot your own damn tires out. Yes, sir or ma'am, whoever sent that in. Shoot your own tires out for week 18 against the Buffalo Bills. We continue the conversation with the New England Patriots, but we do so by proxy and by way of the New York Jets. A story from Sportskeeda talking about the future for the Jets mentions the future for the Patriots in a certain way, shape, or form. I'll read this directly. Mike Vrabel is a popular name among Jets fans as the team's next head coach, but few in the league believe it will happen. The feeling is that Vrabel will use the Jets as leverage to get the job he wants at the salary he wants. Word is that the Las Vegas Raiders will make a run at Vrabel, but people don't believe he wants the job either. Vrabel wants the New England Patriots job, people close to him tell me. And this is a draft writer, Tony Pauline, who is writing about this for Sportskeeda. He wants the Patriots job, but the other half of that is, but Robert Kraft seems intent on bringing back Gerard Mayo, at least at present time. This is not the first time that we've heard the Vrabel is interested in the Patriots job report come out. The first one that I at least remember hearing and hearing be reacted to on the station was from Tom Curran. I think it was 2 weeks ago when he and Albert Breer were talking on NBC Sports Boston about where the Patriots would go at the head coach position. Because I think if the timeline serves right in my head, these conversations started popping up and started getting loud after the Arizona game because it was a bad loss off a bye, followed by the bad press conference, followed by your classic Monday morning walk back on the Greg Hill show. And that led to the fever pitch, or that led to the fervor, I should say, around the coaching position for the Patriots to get to an all-time high, at least from what I remember hearing this season. So it was around then where everybody kind of started scrounging around for, all right, who's going to be the next coach of the Patriots? Because this guy is literally going to talk himself out of this job with the walkbacks, with the lies, and with the we're going to do one thing and do the other. And, oh, we're starting Ramondre, or we're starting Antonio, then we start Ramondre, then he only gets two carries, blah, 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 blah. All that stuff at the time, and there's still certainly a subset of Patriots fans who believe this, we're going to get him fired from what seemed to be one of the most secure minimum 2 years at the job jobs in football, which was the heir apparent to Bill Belichick and Gerard Mayo coaching the New England Patriots. So that's where the Vrabel chatter kind of started. And that's the one that I've seen most often since then for the people who are in the Fire Mayo camp. And if you are going to make a change at the head coach position, that is the one that I certainly would understand the most. He may not be the most popular candidate at this point, because at this point, Ben Johnson, offensive coordinator for the Detroit Lions, honestly, both Lions coordinators, but specific to Johnson, Johnson seems to be, he's the belle of the ball. He's the one that everybody quietly is hoping will take their job to transform their offense. And Ben Johnson has been extremely cautious over the last two hiring cycles of which interviews he even takes, let alone what job he's going to take. He's waiting for the perfect job to open up. I know Drake May is a very good quarterback with a lot of talent. Ben Johnson is never taking this Patriots job with this roster as currently constructed and with the people in the front office who are in charge of constructing it.
Boom, Indy.
There you go. He may want to work with Drake May. I hate to break it to you, but there are plenty of very good quarterbacks in this league that he could work with while also having a roster that's not in shambles. Unless you're giving this about-to-be first-time head coach some kind of say in roster construction, which I also think would be jumping the gun and overcommitting to a guy that's coached, that's been a head coach exactly zero times in the NFL. Unless you're doing that, he's not coming. So take Johnson out of the conversation. If your goal as the Crafts and the leadership group in New England is to maintain the continuity of the post-Belichick era, which based on everything that we've seen, everything that we've heard, and everything that they've done over the last year is what they want to do. I'm not saying that's right or wrong. For people who say get rid of anything that has anything to do with Belichick and clean house, I certainly understand where you're coming from, and that's probably the way that you get back to being competitive in the modern day NFL quickest. But it does not seem like they have the stomach to do that. That's why you name a head coach in waiting multiple years before Belichick is gone, because you wanna continue with this internal Patriots culture, and now, you know, the alumni move up through the system and they're the coaches, and you know, and they continue what made you so successful. If you want to continue doing that, that's fine. And the one guy that realistically allows you to continue to promote from within, in that you're giving Patriots alumni the chance to now coach the team, the one guy that allows you to remain internal in a sense of the term, although he is being hired after coaching for another team, he's internal in that he's fully ingrained in the Patriots fabric. The one guy that allows you to do that, but actually bring in with somebody with experience as a head coach, is Mike Vrabel. So I'm not surprised in the least that he's interested. I would not be surprised in the least if the Crafts were interested in return. There's a good resume there. The first few years in Tennessee were good. He made a lot out of a team that had Ryan Tannehill as the quarterback. So, and the one thing you will have to do, you're going to have to pair him with a good offensive coordinator. So, may I suggest, I know the name is Josh McDaniels that everybody would want. I'd be really fascinated to see if they can make that happen. I feel like that's realistic. I would not be surprised if maybe the Vrabel and McDaniels call log was a lengthy one during the course of this football season. Maybe just quietly analyzing what's going on in New England and what they would hypothetically do if they were given the opportunity to coach this team and right this ship. I would also posit probably potentially maybe losing his job, Brian Daboll, would be interesting to work with Drake May and see if you could really make the most out of that Josh Allen comparison that was floating around so much on draft day. I watched working in New York, I watched all of the HBO Giants offseason Hard Knocks deal, which I still can't believe the Giants actually allowed those cameras in their building. That clip of the ownership group and front office group talking about Saquon Barkley and then the negotiation that Joe Shane had with Barkley's agent on the phone is going to live in Giants infamy for the rest of time. I couldn't believe it, Tom, when I was watching that in working in New York. You know, you're in the middle of the summer. I do anything in my power not to talk about the Yankees. So fine, I'll talk about the Giants on Hard Knocks every day that came out. I could not believe that they greenlit that stuff to go on television.
There were so many bad clips. My personal favorite is the GM's kid being like, "You got to make the trade for Drake May. You have to. Like, you only get one shot at this job, Dad."
Yeah.
And there's rumors that the Jets owner's kid is, like, controlling the organization. Get the Giants kid in control of the organization because he knows what he's talking about. He knows a thing or two about what he's talking about.
Yeah, and Joe Shane doesn't. But anyways, that is a diversion from the point that is to be made. There may be a chance that Brian Daboll would be interested in that. And I mean he certainly did a lot in terms of the development of Josh Allen. Now it's interesting, I will say, that in the post-Daboll era, now Allen is an MVP candidate and he's cut down on the turnovers, but I don't think that's a Daboll thing. I think it's more of a personnel thing in the way that the wide receiver room was constructed around him and just the natural maturation of the player. I don't think that there's anything there. It's interesting timing, but either way, I digress. As a consolation prize to not getting Josh McDaniels under the headset as your OC and kind of the head coach of the offense, so to speak, that would be a very, very interesting way to go. I say all of this in the fact that Vrabel is using the Jets as leverage. Also, quick aside on that, Patriots fans, you're still not the Jets. So just be thankful that you're not the team, even though you stink and you have two players on your roster that you're excited about. You at least have cap space, draft capital, and seemingly a plan for the future and some semblance of control and calmer waters compared to stories about your owner's sons building the team via an Xbox. So you're at least not 32 out of 32 when it comes to the best and worst situations in football. But the Vrabel information, the fact that he may or may not be using the Jets as leverage for a better opportunity, and the fact that he is interested in coaching the New England Patriots, is the second half, the other domino to fall, that would have to be triggered by the firing of Jerod Mayo, which I've settled on it's not going to happen. And even if they go out and get trounced in week 18, I think there's going to be an organizational understanding that we are punting, pun intended, on this game against the Buffalo Bills. And I don't think he's going anywhere. I think there's a very legitimate possibility that a coordinator, if not both coordinators, are gone. And I think there's plenty of justification, especially with the player-to-player regression on the defensive side of the football. Something's got to give there. So I would have to imagine that's where they would want to start. Although the report that was put out by Ian Rappaport last weekend on NFL Network specifically mentioned the name Alex Van Pelt in terms of where the focus could go in terms of essentially scapegoating your coordinators. So I'm not absolving AVP. The offense has been extremely inconsistent in terms of the play calling, the propensity for explosive plays, Drake May either being allowed to run or not allowed to run with the ball, and design runs, not just scrambling. So I could easily see changes at the coordinating positions. And I think that there's a big argument for that. You need to bring in some kind of veteran presence on this coaching staff. You need to have some kind of guiding force to help out your now second year head coach. And that's a delicate balance to strike because you also need to get somebody who is willing to work in lockstep with your head coach versus just waiting for their opportunity to get in the big chair. So that's a delicate balance that you have to have. And you also have to find coaches that are willing to take the job and work with this Patriots roster. You're going to have to pay your suck tax for the roster and for the coaching staff in order to get the guys you want, or even your B choice in terms of your coordinators. Probably should look at specifically the coaching on offense for the wide receivers, because that group has taken approximately zero steps forward and a bunch of steps back. But I just don't see the head coach change coming after 1 year. As tumultuous of a year as it's been, as many bizarre comments that we've seen, And as many times as Patriots fans have been tearing their hair out because of the coaching and the discipline and the walking back and just the very anti-Patriot way of going about things in year one for Jerod Mayo, he's a Kraft guy. He was the Kraft's guy. He was the guy they identified years ago to be the heir apparent. And I just don't think they're going to pull the plug on that. And quite honestly, the only candidate that I look at and go, they might go back on their word for this guy, would be Mike Vrabel, because of all that he has to do with the Patriots dynasty and Patriots lore and all of that. I still don't think it's gonna happen. And Vrabel's going to try. He's going to use it for as much leverage as he can. But still, I'm on the side of it's not going to happen. The changes will be elsewhere on the coaching staff. But we do have to take a break. We will take it right now. Coming up, we will switch over to the Boston Celtics. Big win for them. Starting to find their form at just the right time as an offense, because the month of January, their New Year's resolution should be to survive the month of January. That schedule is brutal, and we'll break that down after Tom tells you what's trending. Back here on WEEI, New Year 2025, and the Celtics ended 2024 in a dominant fashion. By the way, that was the request of the breakdown by people under the stairs, from somebody in the 603 on the text line. So feel free to send in other requests if you're looking for something to come back from break from. 617-779-7937. My good friend Tom is on the ones and twos, and so he'll find it. And for that one, we couldn't find the clean version, so we had to go with an instrumental. But hopefully that still scratched your itch. A couple of texts to wrap up with on the Patriots before we go over to the Celtics. Pat should bring Vrabel in as defensive coach and guarantee him the next man up in the head coaching position. Another message says, no to retreads or friends of the Pats. Vrabel's record was barely 500. We need new blood with new ideas. Ironic that those are the two texts that were sent within 3 minutes of each other, but they're advocating for almost completely different things. And that's a lot of what you see with this Patriots fan base in all aspects of life. I feel like the only thing that I've seen pretty much a consensus on is we don't trust Elliott Wolf in the front office. But coaching staff, I've seen go both ways. Draft strategy go both ways. Roster is completely up for debate right now. You're welcome to the person who said thank you for the song that we came back with. But specific to bringing in Vrabel as the defensive coach and guaranteeing him as the next man up, I don't love that. First of all, I don't know if he would accept it. So that's certainly something to consider. Would he want to work for the Patriots so much that he would forego the chance to be a head coach of a team in the NFL to be the defensive coordinator? That would be a level of love for this team that certainly fans would appreciate, and I would appreciate. I don't know if he's willing to take a step back to work under Jerod Mayo, and I just don't love the dynamic of telling somebody else that, hey, there's a good chance we're going to fire this head coach and we're going to make you the next head coach. Because obviously, at least in a frontward-facing perspective, Vrabel's going to do everything he can as the defensive coordinator in this situation to try to make this team successful. But does it really set up the best work dynamic when you have a former head coach who knows that he is one bad season away from being the head coach in his dream job, and then your current head coach is looking over his shoulder? I don't like that specific part of it. I think having Vrabel on the staff makes your coaching staff better. There's no question about that. I don't like the setup of telling somebody, hey, you're next. Now, if it just happens naturally, that's different. If Jerod Mayo trusts Mike Vrabel to be his defensive coordinator, they have a bad year, Mayo gets fired, Vrabel gets promoted, and it happens naturally, and it happens through the approval of the head coach, and he just so happens to have hired his replacement, that's different. But giving him the A-OK and saying, hey, man, you're our guy. We're just kind of waiting this guy out. So just give us some time. I don't like that. That's not the way I'd go about it. On the other side, the Patriots need new blood with new ideas. There's something I'm interested in, because all of these spare parts that you've kind of tried to put together, all of these square pegs that you've tried to throw into round holes, from front office down to coaching staff down to roster construction, there's not a lot of continuity from part to part to part within this franchise. So if you're part of the strip it down to the studs group with the Patriots and basically bring in new and fresh in every different aspect of the organization, that's, though it's drastic, is it really wrong? I think there's certainly some credence if you feel like that kind of drastic change and just completely leaving the Belichick and Brady era completely behind you. I think that somebody could argue their way around that and do a very good job doing it. But we'll transition back onto the court for a moment. The Celtics win by 54 points from our guy Justin Turpin from WEEI. There have been 7 50-point wins in franchise history. 3 of them came in the calendar year of 2024. Boston finished 2024 with a 78-24 total record, including playoffs, outscoring opponents by 10.79 points per game. He finishes the tweet with just one word, with a period at the end: dominance. And that's exactly what that is. However, the schedule moving forward for the Boston Celtics to begin 2025 is rough. First and foremost, this coming from Mass Live, the Celtics play 10 of their 16 games on the road, which includes 2 separate 4-game road trips. Mixed in there are also 3 back-to-backs, meaning the Celtics will need to lean on their depth heavily next month. But it's not just the sheer amount of games or where they are. It's also about the quality of opponents. The Celtics start the month with a 4-game road trip at the Timberwolves, Rockets, Thunder, then Nuggets, in that order. All 4 of those teams are playoff caliber foes, including the 2023 champs in Denver. There's also a back-to-back mixed in there for Minnesota and Houston games. Later in the month, the Celtics embark on another 4-game road trip: the Warriors, Clippers, Lakers, then Mavericks, in that order. Again, those will be some tough foes, teams who are all set at or above the 500 mark. Clippers and Lakers games will also be a back-to-back in Los Angeles. The Seeds could miss Mavs star Luka Doncic, which is important to note. The Celtics do have some layups on their schedule: the Pelicans twice, the Raptors again, and the Kings. The schedule also features teams who have already given them a loss, in the likes of the Bulls, the Hawks, and, oh God, those damn Orlando Magic. Certainly a schedule that will test the mettle of the Boston Celtics, coming off of a couple of games that seem to happen right at the right time for their offense over the last 3. 125-71, the score yesterday. Now, this was a relatively close game. It was a 10-point game at the half. But then the Celtics came out and outscored Toronto 45-18, and then outscored them again 35-18 in the third and fourth quarters. And yesterday was just everything clicking, and it's so, so fun to watch. It's beautiful to watch when all of the parts of the Celtics machine click at the same time, when all of the cogs mesh together, when the ball's moving. And there's a direct correlation between the Celtics' number of assists in a basketball game and their level of dominance, because that's the one unique part about the sheer amount of threes that the Celtics shoot, is that so many of them are assisted. And when they're playing at their best, it's not just, you know, run up the court, spot up 3, back up. It's not 3-and-D for the Celtics. It's very much get into your set, use the shot clock to your advantage, find the open guy. Usually, all 5 of the guys on the floor for the Celtics happen to be able to spot up and take a 3. So find the open man, move it around, get the defense out of their set, get the open shot, knock it down. And if you do that well enough, you usually win basketball games. That is what was happening yesterday for everybody who was not named Al Horford. So It's a feather in the cap for the Celtics to win in the way that they did. It's a feather in the cap also to start to get some players pointed back in the right direction. 25 minutes and 14 points for Drew Holiday in his return. He was 5 of 8 from the field and 4 of 5 from behind the arc. So a strong game for him. Strong game for Peyton Pritchard off the bench. 19 points, 7 of 13 shooting, and 5 of 8 from 3. And there is also a big correlation between when he's playing well, you do start to, you do really see the Celtics find that extra gear in terms of they can rest some of their guards. They can pick a name out of a hat, and the presumptive sixth man of the year can come in, knock down a couple of shots, and you're really not missing a beat. He went through three games in which the Celtics went 1-2, 6 points, 7 points, 4 points did Peyton Pritchard, where he shot 2 of 7, 3 of 7, and 1 of 9 from the field, and then 2 of 6, 1 of 5, and 0 for 8. Golly, from behind the arc. That was that game against Philadelphia. Even if he hit one, I mean, we're talking about a game with a much different complexion, especially down the stretch. But he had a breakout game, 32 minutes, 18 points against Indiana, 21 points in the loss to the Pacers 2 days later, and then 19 points in 23 minutes, I should say, against Toronto. He's been 7 of 13 from the field in each of his last two games. So there's obviously a lot to love. He's certainly finding his form over the last couple of games, and you're going to need every bit of reinforcements that you have when you talk about a stretch of games like this in a Western Conference that is just beating the daylights out of each other. Oklahoma City is far ahead of the pack right now, 27-5 on the season. They've won 12 games in a row. Good Lord. And I saw a poll that was floating around on Twitter yesterday that named, I don't remember who exactly was surveyed. I think it was just anonymous executives across all of the four major sports. They ranked the top 10 front offices in professional sports. And the Oklahoma City Thunder, of all teams, were ranked as having the best front office in professional sports right now. It's remarkable in a sense, but then you look at the way that in the post-Durant, Westbrook, and Harden era, they've been able to build up a just beyond dominant roster of young and very talented players. There's a lot of credence to that. I know the Celtics were, I think, sixth on that list, if memory serves. Los Angeles Dodgers were second. So, you know, if you can defer all of the money in the world, then that's the kind of list that you get up on. But to the point that I was trying to make, you know, half an hour ago, the Memphis Grizzlies 23-11, Houston Rockets 21-11. Then you have Dallas at 20-13, Denver 18-13, the Clippers 19-14. The Warriors are at 16-16 at .500 right now. They're 3-7 in their last 10, so they've gone through a bit of a rough patch, but they're still a very good basketball team. So the West behind Oklahoma City, there's only a 6-game gap between 2nd and 10th in the Western Conference. Kind of a similar-ish setup in the East, but it's really kind of three tiers in the East. It's Cleveland by themselves. It's the Celtics 5 games back and the Knicks 6 games back. So there's tier one, which is Cleveland. Tier two, which is Boston and New York. And then it's Orlando, who's 20-14, 9.5 games back of Cleveland. And there's only a 5-game gap in the Eastern Conference between 4th and 10th, which is the Detroit Pistons at 14-18. So you can see right there, you have three teams that are in the playoffs right now in the East that are under .500, and there are none in the West that are in the playoff picture there. You have Phoenix, who is a game behind Golden State at 15-17, but you have a lot of very talented teams under the Oklahoma City Thunder, and you're going to run through most of them as the calendar turns to January. The Celtics were winners. The Bruins were not. We'll go to the ice for a moment. Don't forget, we're also going to talk college football. We're going to do that with Max Chadwick of Pro Football Focus at 12:20, as we are now fully into the college football playoffs. First round games. We had one last night. We have three coming up today, all three of which can be heard right here on WEEI. Before we go to break, Tom, you are a Celtics fan. Did I miss anything in my Celtics chatter? Is there anything that's kind of caught your eye recently as the Celtics have gone through, I guess, what you would consider to be a rough patch by their standards?
Yeah, it definitely would be a rough patch. Losing 4 of your last 6 before that Raptors game is a tough look for a team that's supposed to be the best in the NBA. They are the best in the NBA. They're just not healthy right now, and that's a huge thing. But Peyton Pritchard, you hit the nail on the head. He is really starting to pick back up where he was at the start of the season, which is awesome. Because without Kristaps Porzingis, he really fills that vacuum of just putting points on the board.
Yeah.
When Porzingis is out, they need that 15, 16, 20-point game from Peyton Pritchard. And he picks up the slack when Kristaps Porzingis is out. And he has a lot freer play, I would say, when Porzingis is out, because yeah, he can be that guy off the bench.
Right.
So I love what I'm seeing from Pritchard. Jrue Holiday coming back, showing consistency from behind the line is huge. He was the most consistent corner three shooter from the league last year in the playoffs. Going to need that back in the playoffs. But again, it all comes back down to just surviving this road trip. It's not going to be fun. It's going to be tough, but you guys are built for this. You're going to see a lot of minutes from Tillman, Kata. I wouldn't be surprised if Jordan Walsh gets in there as well. He's been down to the G League working on his three-point shot, which is huge because he's kind of supposed to be that Grant Williams replacement, and Grant Williams was the replacement for Al Horford when he left the first time.
Right.
So he needs to show some growth as well in these upcoming months because Horford, as much as we love Al Horford, he's on the back nine, and he's on 17 of that 18-hole stretch on nine.
Yeah, and he's putting on 17, too. Like, yes, he's not even teeing off on that. So, yeah, I understand where you're coming from. Good points all around on the Boston Celtics. We'll go to the ice when we return, and then at the top of the hour at 12 o'clock, Jerod Mayo spoke to the media for his weekly press conference. We'll dissect some of his comments, Drake May's comments about playing this weekend, all that coming up at the top of the 12 o'clock hour as well. Some Bruins talk, meanwhile. That is next. 617-779-7937 is the number. You can call that number. You can text that number. If you want to get involved in the conversation in any way, shape, or form, that is how you do it. You can also tweet us if you want. I'm at Dan Ball, B-A-H-L. Feel free to send a tweet, send a follow, whatever you want. We are up with you until 1 o'clock here this afternoon in for Jones and Keefe as we get you into coverage of the college football playoff first round. Three games on the docket today beginning at 1 o'clock. We'll have complete wall-to-wall coverage for you all the way through the end of game number three right here on WEEI. And we'll preview those games with Max Chadwick of Pro Football Focus. He is a college football analyst. He's going to join the show at 12:20 today. Bruins started off rip-roaring hot. Justin Brazo, a minute and 21 seconds in, his ninth goal of the season. By the way, a really, really nice little find for your bottom six there, Justin Brazo, who ended up playing 16 minutes. He got 2 minutes and 15 seconds worth of power play time. A guy that you kind of picked off the scrap heap from the Toronto Maple Leafs, which for my money makes it even better. But he's a 6'6", 227 tank. And he's developed into a really nice power forward, which is why my New Year's resolution was play some of the kids, because looks like you got a little something, at least in your middle six to bottom six with some of these younger guys. And Brazo's become a pretty good piece. And he scored early. Bruins were looking great a minute and 21 seconds in. They're up 1-0. Then the car kind of stalled out as the game was going along. Two goals for the Capitals later on in the first period. Alexei Protas is 15th, and Jacob Chychrun, the defenseman, with his 11th goal of the season on the power play to make it 2-1, and then no scoring in the game until 9 seconds remain when Protas scored into the empty net. 3-1 your final, so Bruins finished the 2024 calendar year at 20-15-4. 44 points. They're now 4 points back of both Florida and Toronto, who are the pace cars at the top of the Atlantic Division, 23-13-2. 2 points clear of Tampa, 4 points clear of Ottawa, and then it kind of cascades down from there. And those poor Buffalo Sabres, man, 14-20-4, still bringing up the rear in the Atlantic Division. But, you know, there's been a pretty significant change in just the energy, the compete, and the characteristics that you expect from a Boston Bruins team, especially one that doesn't have all-world talent littered up and down the lineup. This is not the first year, nor will it be the last year, that the Bruins ice a team that is not the most talented on the ice on more nights than it's not. There's like a quadruple negative in that sentence, but bear with me as I explain my point. In years past, when the Bruins have gone through roster transitions, they usually made up for a lot of their issues talent-wise with, well, we're just going to outwork you, and then our goalie's going to play extremely well. We'll beat you 2-1. We'll beat you 3-2. And that's how they did a lot of winning through the 2010s. In the late Tim Thomas era, into the Tuukka Rask era, into the Linus Allmark and Jeremy Swayman era. Neither of those were consistently present at the beginning of the season with Jim Montgomery, and that's why you saw a change at the coaching position. Yes, the Montgomery era ended with some really, really poor goaltending from Jeremy Swayman and some very inconsistent goaltending, let's call it, from Jonas Korpisalo, coming off of the era where you had Linus Allmark there to make up for whatever sins Jeremy Swayman may have had, even though there were very few. So goaltending was the issue, and there wasn't that same fight in the dog that you're used to seeing with these Bruins teams. And that's where you saw the change. And there was a pretty immediate new coach bump that you got against some pretty bad teams. But there was a new coach bump, and you started to see flashes of the culture that's made Boston the winningest team in the last, I think it was at least 10 seasons, the winningest team in the regular season in hockey. So you got that bump. You beat the Canadiens, beat the Red Wings, beat the Blackhawks, beat the Flyers. Then you went on the road and lost 8-1 to the Jets. And it's, oh, all right, new coach bump is over. It's gone. This team came cratering back to earth. You lose 8-1 to the Jets and 5-1 to the Kraken. 13 goals against over a two-game span. But you respond with wins against the Canucks and the Flames, overtime loss against the Oilers to end that road trip, and then you won 3 of your next 4, beating the Sabres and the Blue Jackets, which is nothing to write home about. You also lost 6-2 to the Blue Jackets on the road. But you beat the Capitals 4-1. And that win, combined with the wins against the Flames and the Canucks and the fact that you took Edmonton to overtime in the final game of that road trip, kind of signaled, hey, you know, there's a little bit more in this team that for some reason, and it'll be, you know, fascinating to hear it dissected for years and years to come, there's something here under Joe Sacco. There's something here in these last few weeks that Jim Montgomery just was no longer able to pull out of this group. He wasn't able to extract that kind of effort, that kind of fire, that kind of passion. And it's not as though Montgomery didn't have passion. He was an extremely passionate and fiery guy. He was lighting up players on the bench and benching players. He was trying to push the right buttons. It was just a shockingly obvious example of a coach's message falling on deaf ears, which is also pretty amazing given how much success this team has had in the regular season. But it from Jump Street just wasn't clicking this year. Whether it was a change in locker room dynamic, it seemed like a lot of the frustration was channeled through and with David Pastrnak, which just happened to be a factor of life, and he's a very highly paid player, very skilled player. Defense and back checking are never going to be the foundation of his game, but, you know, that seemed to be where a lot of it happened, and the message was just falling on deaf ears. But what you can say unequivocally is that the messaging coming from the coaching staff as currently constructed seems to be getting through. You're starting to get not the most out of your players, but you're certainly getting more. You're getting more consistent efforts, more times than not, and certainly more times than you were in the previous regime. The issue right now, and the issue that came through against a good defensive team with a goaltender who was playing well yesterday, is scoring. It's secondary scoring. It's the fact that David Pastrnak has 13 goals and 37 points. Brad Marchand has 15 goals and 31 points. And then your next closest point scorer is Elias Lindholm with a very highly paid 19 points in 39 games. Pavel Zacha, 18. Justin Brazo, 17. Mason Lauri, Charlie McAvoy, both with 16. You only have three goal scorers in double digits to this point in the season. You're just not putting the puck in the net. And unfortunately, you just don't have players who are capable of putting the puck in the net on this roster. Elias Lindholm's a very good player. He's not a goal scorer. Same can be said for Pavel Zacha. Same can be said for Charlie Coyle, who does have 10 goals, which is a good number. 3 assists, though. Good Lord. But again, you don't have somebody who could actually put the puck in the net. You have a lot of good players who play their role well, good defensive two-way players, some good, power forwards, checking line players. You just don't have enough players who can wire the damn thing. You have 2 players who can legitimately score at an elite level in the NHL, and that's just not good enough. So you'll continue to be competitive because you have enough decent NHL players where you'll beat bad teams, and every now and again you'll put up an effort like you did against Washington where you'll surprise somebody. But, I mean, the Boston Bruins do not hide from what they are. Look at the games that they've played. You score 1 goal and lose against Washington, 4 against Columbus, which is like amazing that you got to that number, 2 against Columbus, 4 against Washington, 3 against Buffalo, 2 against Edmonton, 4 against Calgary, 5, God bless them, against Vancouver, then 1-1, 4-4, 3. This team does not score in bunches. If you get to that 3-goal mark, if you can get above that 3-goal mark, God forbid, you win most of your games. But there are too many games where it's 1 goal and 2 goals. They're rarely shut out, but there's a whole lot of 1 goal scored in a lot of these games. So if you are of a mind where you want to invest in this team and make it better, you have to find somebody who's going to put the puck in the net. Now, do we advocate for being aggressive and adding to this team as currently constructed? No, I wouldn't. But you have to pick a direction and stick to it. As Tom said in his New Year's resolutions off the top of the show, look in the mirror, be honest about what you are, figure out if this team is indeed worth investing in. And if you're going to do it, somebody has to put the damn puck in the net if you want to compete and win a playoff round. You're finally at a point where you're starting to restock all of this draft capital that you traded away. You have your first round pick this year, next, and in 2027. No second round pick or fourth round pick this year. But other than that, you're pretty well stocked. So if you want to trade draft assets, you're also going to need to give something off your roster because you don't have a lot of cap space to work with. Which brings up a very interesting conversation about impending unrestricted free agent Trent Frederick. And is there a team that's willing to give him a fresh start, that sees value in this player and his $2.3 million contract and sees value in possibly signing him to an extension? He has not performed well, so the answer to that question may be no at this point. There may not be a team that looks at Trent Frederick and says, yeah, I'm willing to invest. I'm willing to give you the goal scorer you need for a guy that has 11 points in 39 games and is a minus 12. There's not a lot there. Now, if he was building off of his season last season, in which he had 40 points in 82 games, coming off of a 31-point season the season before, and had 18 goals, beautiful. There's something here. If you were sniffing around that point every other game and near 20-goal scorer kind of guy, that's a valuable piece that a team may want to invest in as a middle six winger. The step back right now for Trent Frederick is doing a couple of different things. He's hurting your team currently, which is never good because you need scoring where you can get it. That's one. He's hurting his trade value, and he's costing himself some money when he gets to free agency. So decisions to be made abound. Bruins losers 3-1 to the Washington Capitals as they split their couple of games that they had against the Capitals in the last week or so. We're up against a break. We'll take it here in hour number 3. Reactions to Gerard Mayo and Drake May speaking to the media from just about an hour ago. Plus, Max Chadwick of Pro Football Focus gets us set for the day in college football with his thoughts on the college football playoff. All that and more coming up here on WEEI right after this.